Support for the Studio 360 podcast comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are like a personal trainer for your brain, improving your performance with the science of neuroplasticity, but in a way that just feels like games. Start training today at Lumosity.com.
Today in Studio 360, I know it's a cliche, but is anybody in Hollywood more likable than Tom Hanks?
I love it when a director comes up to me and says, "Don't do that." Then it's gone. I don't even think about it.
Hanks is now making his Broadway debut in Lucky Guy, a play by the late Nora Ephron. And his character, not so likable.
Can you say a**hole on public radio?
I think you can say
a**hole. Oh, there you go. I love this. I love this.
Tom Hanks is ahead this hour.
You're a lucky guy.
Plus, we announced the winners in our Birdsong Remix Listener Challenge.
A beautiful, intimate experience with spring.
Has anything ever more deserved a retweet? That and a lot more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Later this hour, I'll talk with the duo Raul y Mexia. They're the sons of one of the greatest Norteño musicians, but they're going their own musical way. And Tom Hanks will tell us about appearing on Broadway for the first time.
It's like playing an NBA basketball game every night. It's very fast. You're up and down the court, and sometimes you sink it and sometimes you don't, but you get to do it again tomorrow night.
But right now,
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
This week, two different federal courts delivered two important and contradictory-seeming decisions about the way we may and may not consume digital entertainment. One of them involves reselling the music we own but don't really want to hear again. Come on, stop, please. And the other case involves a new digital streaming service that allows customers to watch any and all broadcast TV live over the internet. Adam Liptak covers the law and the Supreme Court for the New York Times, and he has been following these cases. Adam, welcome to Studio 360.
Good to be here, Kurt.
So let's briefly recap. First, the company called Redigi is a platform that lets you resell the digital songs you bought from iTunes. Record companies argue that because the technology requires that a copy be made in that process, it's a copyright infringement, and a judge agreed. So how come and what does this imply?
Well, both of these cases really are about, in the digital age, what's an original, what's a copy. The old copyright concept that once you buy a book, once you buy a CD, it's yours. You can do with it what you want. You can lend it. You can sell it. It's a single material thing, and that's yours to do with as you will. When you buy a digital song, it's different. It sits on your computer. You can perhaps secrete away other copies of it. And this service, which is a little too clever by half, says what it's going to do is search your computer, move it to some kind of secure digital locker, resell it to somebody else. You can't listen to it anymore. You know, it's a lovely idea, but there are problems with it every step of the way, both as a matter of law and as a matter of technology, because they don't know for sure that you haven't kept a copy. And it just doesn't fit with the way the law thinks about this stuff. And it doesn't really fit with technological reality either.
Well, it certainly doesn't fit with the law, which was passed 37 years ago before any of this stuff existed. But on the common sense basis, I still think when I buy a song or buy an album that I've bought it. But this says, nah, you haven't really. You're leasing it. You're licensing it.
Well, what the judge said here is he gets that. And he understands that we'd like to think of it as a CD, which we can take down to the used record shop and get $2 for. But the current law really treats these things as reproductions, as copies, and not as a single unitary material object that you're moving from place to place.
This company at least was trying to do the right thing of saying, no, 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 when you sell it, we're going to disable your ability to play it. So they weren't being the kind of brazen pirates that we've had in the past.
No, they're trying to work it out. And even after this decision, they've announced that they've got a fresh new idea. And, you know, the techies are smart. And maybe they can find something that actually achieves what I don't think anybody should object to, which is if it's a single copy and you're not going to listen to it anymore and somebody else will, why shouldn't you be able to sell that?
The other big digital ruling this week concerned a company called Aereo, which is a new service that streams essentially live broadcast TV to you over the internet if you pay them. This was a federal appeals court, a higher court. What was the ruling there?
So this is another instance which sounds like it might be too clever by half, but this one was just clever enough. The ruling was that just as you can get free broadcast TV by putting rabbit ears on your television,
the way we all used to do.
Right. You can, if you're a Barry Diller-backed company, set up a farm of rabbit ears in Brooklyn and allow people to have their own individually assigned antenna through which they would receive and record through DVRs broadcast television for $8 or $12 a month. And the court, in a preliminary ruling, but an important one, refused to block that business model. And promptly on the heels of the ruling, the company announces that it's going to roll this service out to a couple dozen cities around the country.
So the short version of the takeaway of each of these is record buyers, sorry, TV watchers, you're in luck.
Well, it again turns on this interesting idea of what's unique, what's one at a time. And here the court was persuaded that the individual antenna makes it enough of a one of a time thing.
Have you, unlike me, used either of these services?
No, I haven't. But people younger than us, Kurt, really, really hate paying the $200 cable bill. So I think this service plus Netflix plus Hulu, you can basically get the complete menu of what you want to watch, including with this, the Super Bowl and the Oscars and so on, which is the missing link in a lot of people's viewing habits. So I think that this Aereo thing really could be huge.
So what is the likelihood of these cases ending up before the Supreme Court?
Well, it's almost impossible to write a newspaper article about the law without a line in there saying these cases could go to the Supreme Court. But both of these are the kinds of things the court might well be interested in, if for no other reason than the economic stakes are so high and the lawyers on both sides are so good that it may be something the court feels it needs to weigh in on.
Although, as you say, the piecemeal approach by courts doesn't seem to be what we as a society really want. So I guess back to Congress. It really is up to the Congress of the United States to massively redraft these laws.
The correct answer would be for the Copyright Act to take account of where we are now, not in 1976. But given the huge economic interests on both sides and Congress's propensity for gridlock to begin with, I wouldn't put a big bet on that. Right. So the correct answer is it should be Congress, and the likely real-world answer is it's going to be the courts.
Adam Liptak, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Adam Liptak covers the law and the Supreme Court for the New York Times. So tell us what you think. Should we be able to resell our used MP3s? Should it be legal to stream live broadcast TV over the internet without the networks getting a dime? Do the confusions of our digital era make your brain feel like exploding sometimes? Leave us a comment at studio360.org. A few weeks ago, we posed a challenge to create an original musical composition on the theme of spring using one or more of the bird songs we posted on our website. We gave you a dozen samples from the vast collection of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And you made more than 100 pieces of new music, all kinds of music, plus some spoken word pieces and a little drama. All of them are posted up at studio360.org, and now that spring finally feels like it's sprung, we're going to pick a winner. Joining me now is Greg Budney, the curator of audio at the Cornell Ornithology Lab and a Studio 360 judge. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks, Kurt. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So we got an enormous variety of musical styles and approaches. Let's talk about the runners-up. You really liked this track by Phil Torres from Durham, North Carolina. His piece is called It's Not Spring Yet, But It's Getting There.
That really captured the vibrancy of the northern latitudes when life is exploding out of dormancy. We're beginning to undergo a period of renewal, and it It also had that great rhythm of spring well underway.
The one I really loved, and it's by Jeremy Strong from New Jersey, and it's not actually technically musical, but I loved it so much I had to give it a shout out. It's called Uninvited Giant Meadowlark, and it's more of a drama than a song, but let's play it. And it's short and sweet and makes its point.
I thought it worked beautifully. And the reaction was exactly what I would have done.
Exactly. Now it is time for the winner, who is Marlo Reynolds of Philadelphia. His track is called, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Certhia Americana. Is that right?
That is correct.
Which is the Latin name for the brown creeper.
Tiny woodland birds heard with piercing calls. In mature woods, they rise and fall. Camouflage and inconspicuous in this shady forest, this little brown and white chorus. Spiraling up stout trunks and main branches, passing downward facing nut hatches. Probing crevices with slender down curved bills, peeling flakes of barks and parks in the winter. The song of the brown creeper enters.
And before we talk about it, let's call Marlo and let him know he's the winner.
Hello?
Hi, is this Marlo?
This is.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt.
Hi, and I'm here along with Greg Budney, who is my fellow judge and the curator of the Cornell Ornithology Lab.
Wow, wonderful.
And I want to thank you for sending us your work. We got about 120 compositions,
mm-hmm.
and you are the winner of our challenge.
Are you kidding?
I'm not.
That is unbelievable. That's making my day. It's like unbelievable.
How did you get the idea for this piece?
Well, first I started with the pack of sounds that you guys had of the bird songs, and I just listened for the one that I felt was the most rhythmic. And the song of the brown creeper was the one that I heard first. All these like ideas started coming into my head of ways to edit it and play with it in the computer.
One of the things that really resonated with me about your piece, Marlo, is that I've had that experience, the early portion of spring, being in the field and hearing that song before the leaves are out in the trees and also seeing nuthatches. I thought your natural history detail was spot on.
Well, I can't take credit for the poem because that was read by my good friend in this piece, music collaborator Gump.
Well, it was just a beautiful, intimate experience with spring.
Marlo, what do you do for a living when you're not entering contests to write music?
Right now, I'm looking for a job composing music for nature documentary or a composition for film.
And have you ever worked with nature sounds?
Yeah, that's the work that I've been doing, like for myself, like the hobby music that I'm doing does include a lot of nature sounds. In fact, I have a field recorder and I do a lot of field recording. And
I understand you've done some field recording in China of birdsong?
Yeah, that I don't know what birds they are. I could probably sing the song to you.
I'll bet Greg does.
Really?
Well, I mean, if he heard your recordings.
If I could whistle a passage, do you think you could identify the bird, Greg?
You guys are really putting me on the spot here. Well, it sounds like an old world warbler.
Wood warbler.
It sounds very similar to a bird called Setia diphone, which would be a very typical bird of Asia.
Okay.
And by the way, Marlo, you whistle really well.
I've spent a lot of time out in the trees listening to that particular call. And I have a bunch of recordings of those and some other birds and actually a lot of bees, too.
Maybe you could send us one of those sounds and we could put it online and we can keep this thing going. And people could then use your field recording to compose music around, if you wouldn't mind.
That sounds wonderful.
Excellent. Yeah. Marlo, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
Greg, thank you for helping us judge this and bringing this extraordinary resource to our attention, to Marlo's attention, to the attention of 120 other composers. Thanks.
My pleasure.
You can hear all 120 compositions at studio360.org. And I want to thank everybody who entered. It was awesome to see what you all came up with. And although the contest is over, we will keep those dozen Cornell Ornithology Lab bird songs available on our website for your remixing pleasure. And we'll be playing more of our favorite entries throughout this hour.
Often heard, but hard to see under the sun.
Coming up, memorizing the lines for a live play can be a challenge for an actor used to shooting movies in bits and pieces. Here's some advice from a guy who's been through it, Tom Hanks.
It's like listening to your favorite album over and over again. I could probably recite to you every word of Bruce Springsteen's Darkness on the Edge of Town. And that's what it's like. It's like you learn the record and you know what's coming up next. You know how long the pauses are. You know when the trumpets blare.
Tom Hanks is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Tom Hanks hasn't had one remarkable, universally familiar movie role. He's had a dozen.
May I ask who you are?
My name's Forrest. Forrest Gump.
I have a case. If you don't want it for personal reasons.
Thank you. That's correct. I don't.
There's no crying in baseball!
Houston, we have a problem.
We'll see you on the beach.
He's also been a movie director and a TV producer. One thing he doesn't have much experience at is live theater. He hasn't acted in a play since the early 1980s. But Tom Hanks is on Broadway right now, starring in the last work by Nora Ephron. It's called Lucky Guy, and it's about a New York tabloid journalist named Mike McElary.
I am a newspaper reporter, and I love my job. And I'm doing God's work. I'm serving the public. I'm telling people what happened yesterday. I'm telling them the facts.
Unlike a lot of the characters Tom Hanks has played, McElary doesn't have an obvious heart of gold. When he first read the script, Hanks thought McElary seemed like a jerk.
Well, he was. He was just kind of a jerk. Can you say a**hole on public radio?
I think you can say
a**hole. Oh, there you go. I love this. I love this. You know, there's perks and burdens, and that's one of the perks, I guess. And I did not know him. I had not read him. But years later, la la la, da da da. Let's throw the calendar pages, the front.
Cue
pages,
that music too.
The time passing montage music. And a couple of years ago, I saw Nora all the time, and we, you know, talked always about what we were up to. And she said, "Well, I did another version of the play about that guy you said was an a**hole." I said, "Oh, well, let me read it again." And from that came our production at the Broadhurst.
So when was that? When did you commit to this?
I committed to it after we had what is known as a 29-hour workshop production, I'm going to say a year ago last January.
Huh. And a year ago last January, you had, like most of her friends, had no idea she was sick?
I had no idea that she was ill.
Would you have done it if this particular play, if your friend and multiple collaborator Nora Ephron hadn't written it?
Well, she was definitely a great attraction because Nora was a good hang. She was a fun person to spend as much time with as possible. You always ate well. You always laughed. You were always constantly talking about the pulse of the nation and the world at the time. Yes, I think the play was fascinating enough. Wanting to come and do a Broadway show is, I think, in the DNA of every actor that's out there, particularly one that used to live on 45th Street, right around the corner from where the theater is. So, and not knowing the story of Mike McElary, this was brand new turf for me.
And this is the first play you've done in 30 plus?
Bona fide play, yes. I put together performances for the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival as benefits and whatnot over
which the is year. Where you started.
It was in Cleveland, yeah. Actually, now the Great Lakes Theater Festival, for those that are listening in public radio and in Cleveland. Thank you very much.
WCPN.
Oh, heck. Okay, you beat me to it. But no, I have not done a professional play since 1981.
So how well did you and how did you adapt to all of it? The memorizing the lines, the tightrope every night, all that stuff.
That's nothing, really. That's just the process.
Sounds like a scary part of the process.
Well, when you start working on it, I began meeting with Maura Turney, who plays Alice McAlary, and George Wolfe, who was our director, on the 7th of January. And if you can't figure out, you know, the words between now and then, I try to figure, because everybody asks that question, how do you remember all those lines?
And I hope that's the stupid way in which I
No. You actually put in a very challenging form. This is what it's like. It's like listening to your favorite album over and over again. And I would guess I could probably recite to you every word of Bruce Springsteen's Darkness on the Edge of Town. And that's what it's like. It's like you learn the record and you know what's coming up next. You know how long the pauses are. You know when the trumpets blare.
And your mental state the rest of the time is no different than the rest of your life?
I find I keep the play in a box in my head and I don't let anything else in there until I have to open it and then begin. Look, we are still in rehearsal, so I have this kind of like delicious excuse for hiding from everything that goes on in the world. I can't balance my checkbook now. I'm in rehearsals. I can't figure out this email about the kid's school meeting with the parent teacher. I have rehearsals.
So you really get to be an artiste?
Oh, I do. It's all fake, but yeah, I actually do get to have it. I have a beret and everything.
And you're in New York. Do you hang in the village with a cigarette on your fingers?
A herbal cigarette.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I walk around. I used to try to walk around like James Dean, you know, that great iconographic photograph of him with the Times Square with an overcoat and the cigarette. No. And now I try to walk around like Mike McAlary with my tie undone and a cigarette in my mouth.
Doing this show this stage performance in front of 1,000 people every night, are the highs higher than in film acting, or is it just an apple to an orange?
It's an apple to an orange. I think doing Lucky Guy is like playing an NBA basketball game every night. It's rock'em sock'em. It's very fast. You're up and down the court. And sometimes you sink it and sometimes you don't, but you get to play. You get to do it again tomorrow night, which is great. Motion pictures are kind of like war games. There's a lot of the logistics of it all. And sometimes the hours are totally, totally inhuman. But you have to, again, you have to keep the movie and the role inside this box in your head. Because for perhaps 45 minutes, four times a day, you are going to be recording something that is going to last forever. And if you're not truly behaving there at that time, you have failed to do your job.
That seems to me like a more bizarre, unhuman thing, movie acting.
Totally.
Than this. You're 2 hours, you pretend to be somebody else, it's over.
It is. Everybody knows they're in the theater. Yeah. Everybody knows that you're going off stage to change your costumes. The things that happen in motion pictures are the sun is coming up because it's a night shot. You have to cry and have a very emotional scene with somebody else with you. And you literally have today to get it because tomorrow the company is leaving Normandy and they cannot bring everybody back. And you're going to be back in Culver City on Monday morning. It's merciless. It is merciless. And it is a very odd thing. And that's why so many actors start craving nuts after a while. The pressure breaks them.
As an actor in the movies, you have a really high batting average of commercially and creatively successful movies. I mean, I was amazed during the 90s you had like a dozen straight, like, BAFFO things. I mean, really straight. It was incredible.
B-O-F-F-O. That's the
exactly.
way to spell
that. No, I want to speak more like Variety.
Okay. All right. Well,
how much of the credit for those choices would you allocate to luck, your agents, you?
Look, I will have to say luck plays an awful big part of it because somebody has to initiate the phone call to you. At the end of the day, I don't get to make any of these decisions except yes or no. And it is very, very easy to say yes to whatever opportunity comes across the pike. I felt as though at that time in the 90s where things were clicking along pretty well is that that's when I learned to say no to the other things that would have taken me out of the marketplace. There was a time, for example, I sat down with my crack staff of representatives and I said, look, can I say p- talked on the air. Okay. I said, I'm not going to play. And I mean that in the term of like
wusses is the
wusses. Is, okay, yeah. I'm not going to play wusses anymore. I don't want to play a guy who can't figure out his life and does it because that's the type of role I had played from the age of 27 to about 35. And I said, look, I've explored that as much as I want to. I want to play a man who experiences bitter compromise in his life because that's what I've experienced thus far in my life. And that's about the only thing I think you can do. You can't set yourself out to say, I'm only going to do this brand of work, because if nobody asks you to do this brand of work, you'll never have that opportunity. I think you have to surf, if you will, the big waves of chance that come your way because other people were involved. If Ron Howard hadn't cast me in the jobs that he did, if Bob Zemeckis hadn't seen something in Forrest Gump, if Jonathan Demme hadn't cold called me out of nowhere
for Philadelphia,
to do Philadelphia, then I would never have been able to manufacture those opportunities by myself.
And then when you make the very rare mistake, or what people regard as a mistake, like Bonfire of the Vanities, is that traumatizing?
Well, you are going back to the 90s, aren't you?
Is that traumatizing? Or do you say, okay, how do I avoid making that mistake? Or is it just, you make mistakes sometimes?
There's no such thing as and Michael Jordan, you know, he only won so many, you know, champion rings. He played basketball where, you know, they were eliminated in the playoffs in the first or second round. That is just part of the batting average. The thing is, in America, really, they only ask you about the hits. They will go back to the ones that made money, the Forrest Gumps and whatnot. And they only talk about the stuff that was really in the national consciousness so much that they remembered it. In Europe, they always ask you about the last movie they saw.
Tell me about Joe and the Volcano.
They want to say, no, then Larry Crown. I must say, Mr. Hanks, the Larry Crown. And if I mention Larry Crown in the United States, even on Studio 360, it's a punchline. And then, Kurt, along comes Larry Crown. Ba-dum-cha. So it's like that. But look, there's only one yardstick for success, and that is longevity. The more bombs, that means I've had some boffo ones as well. So just put them up there on the shelf, and that means I'm doing okay.
Speaking of Larry Crown, not as a punchline at all.
Oh, I love this.
And that thing you do. So you've directed two feature films.
Yes,
you've directed
yes.
episodes of your wonderful HBO series as well. What have you learned about directing and how it does or doesn't jibe with your skills, the requirements of it versus what you can do?
I think every director should have to act in a movie to see how hard that is to do at 3 o'clock in the morning. I think they should, because then they will become human beings, those that aren't. By and large, I've had great relationship with directors. I think all actors should try to direct something, and they will find out how important it is to have actors show up on time, to know what they are going to do in the scene, and to have ideas beyond those that you have communicated to them. I'm a better collaborator now with writers and directors than I was prior to that, because I just know the constraints that they're under. So I have less ego now, if I can be so bold, humbly.
Yes. Let me tell you how little ego I have.
Let me tell you how humble I am. Let me tell you how little ego I have. I love it when a director comes up to me and says, don't do that. Then it's gone. I don't even think about it anymore. And I love it when a director comes out and says, what was that about? I said, I was just giving it a shot. We'll explore that a little bit more. Well, that's golden, man. Then I feel like I won the sweepstakes.
Speaking of being an actor, when I was thinking about movie clips that we might play during this conversation, I realized that many of your greatest moments in movies are visual, without dialogue. Like
yes.
the dancing in Big and the run in Forrest Gump. I mean, you're kind of a silent movie star in a certain way. And I wonder if that physicality that you bring to particular roles is something you kind of figure out very carefully.
Well, they come out very organically in the course of doing it. And you cannot sit in your hotel room at night and say, I'm going to walk this way. You have to wait till you're there in the real space and you have the real costume on, and you get a sense of how big you are or how large you are in the frame that is communicated to you by the director. But listen, I would love to do a movie that is completely silent. I try to take out as many lines as possible. In fact, storytelling-wise, when Bob Zemeckis and I made Castaway, and we were on the island in Fiji for 6 weeks at a time, we had a script that was written by Bill Broyles and us that was loaded with all this verbiage. Well, what am I going to do now? Well, shoot, that looks like it is an island. Dang, I gotta figure out a way to get some fire here. Literally, he was saying stuff like that, and Bob and I said, There's no reason for him to be talking like this. The only reason to talk is if he thinks somebody is there. So prior to the birth of Wilson the volleyball, who gave me somebody to talk about, the only thing I said, who's there? Thinking someone was out there. Or help, thinking there was a ship out at sea. And all the other lines, it became a silent movie, and it just became about behavior and procedure, which since doing that movie is the thing that I try to, I think that's a strength that I have. Is looking at, well, what is the behavior of a guy here and what is the procedure that he has to go through in order to work the beat in the scene?
In the last decade or so, most of the projects you've worked on as a producer, maybe all of them, have been explorations of American history
yes.
of one kind or another. John Adams, Band of Brothers, Pacific, Game Change, this wonderful documentary series From the Earth to the Moon. Has that always been your sweet spot?
Yes, it has, because I've been reading nonfiction since I was in high school. I discovered In Cold Blood when I was about 15.
Nice.
Yeah, I remember that famous Dick Cavett-Truman Capote argument on air of if it's possible to write a nonfiction novel or something like that. Knowing that that had actually happened and wasn't just the creepy imaginings of a writer really affected me quite deeply. And then I went off and read other versions of the same thing, like Leon Uris's books, Mila 18 and Trinity and Armageddon, Exodus, things like that. And that just always drove me towards being much more fascinated by things that really happened as opposed to novels that have been made up. And I still only read, I drive my wife nuts because there I am reading, you know, another Vincent Bugliosi book or Don Miller's Masters of the Air or something like that in bed because she says, are you ever going to read just a novel? And I said, I don't think so, babe, because it just doesn't have the same juju as knowing that this stuff really happened.
And as an American history specialist, as a
layman, yes,
producer, lay specialist. Do you have a sense of when America's golden age was? You're not running for office.
No. So I don't have to say that. It actually is always. I think it's always around the corner. It truly is. Something will come down the pike that will not be recognized for another 20 years. I think, for example, now, I think we're looking back at, we have been looking at the 60s for quite a while. I was alive from 50, I was born in 56. So for about 15 years, I was told over and over again that we live in amazing times. This is astounding what we are achieving right now. And there was no internet. You know, you made long-distance phone calls over copper wire.
Rarely.
Rarely. And you had to wait for those. If you wrote a letter, you had to put a 6-inch stamp on it, and it took 4 days to get across the country sometime. And yet, we were living in amazing times. The generation right before us had experienced this horrible thing called the Depression. And the generation right before mine woke up one day and had to go down and sign a piece of paper and fly in airplanes and go across the country and fight with monsters. I'm sorry. That's what it was. And then in the 50s, there was this gurgling kind of like a whiff and poof psalm that was right underneath Roy Cohn and Joe McCarthy at the same time. And then when I was...
Nicely put.
When I was actually coming of age... And started doing things like understanding there were newspapers and whatnot and paying more attention to all of history that went on. Some guy decided to climb into a bookstore in Dealey Plaza and take out the most charming human being that had ever graced the political stage. All of that stuff was going on at the same exact time people were telling us, and we live in an amazing, amazing time. And so in the great sweep of the altruistic meter, it may not seem things are at the high point at any given day to day. But look, the greatest opportunities for
right.
us as a nation are always around the
and
corner.
And it's always the best of times and the worst of times.
Yeah, it's always the tale of the two cities.
Tom Hanks, it has been a pleasure, as I knew it would be, talking to you today. Thank you.
Delightful. Thank you. Big time fan, first time caller.
Tom Hanks is starring in Lucky Guy on Broadway. You can hear a longer version of our conversation at studio360.org. A couple of weeks back, I proposed, you said yes. After a conversation with the author of the new book, I Do, I Don't, all about marriage in the movies, I asked you to nominate your favorite on-screen marriages. Armin Pandola from Philadelphia nominated Two for the Road from 1967, starring Audrey Hepburn and Albert Finney.
How long is this going to go on? How long is what going to go on?
That pretends that we're happy.
You've never pretended we're happy. Who's pretending?
You are. That we're happily married, that you're wanting to stay with me.
Those are two entirely different things.
You don't have to tell me.
Armin wrote, they love each other, they hate each other, they come together, they tear apart. In the end, they make each other better together. And that's a great marriage. Mike Lee's Another Year from 2010 got a lot of love from listeners. It's about an aging couple very content with each other amid the turmoil of their friends and family.
You're nice and slim.
Am I? Well, I've always been slim, haven't I?
Unlike me, middle-aged spread.
Shut up. You're perfect, gorgeous in every way, and you know it.
Kristen Rosa from Seattle says Another Year gives her a lot of hope for what marriage can be. Thanks to everybody who wrote in, and you can see all the pics at studio360.org.
You getting married?
Garth, marriage is punishment for shoplifting in some countries.
Still ahead, it's not easy being an American teenager when your father is a legend in Mexico.
Our dad would come home, he's playing the accordion, the balsexto, and you're just kind of like, oh, man, again? Those type of situations, you're just like, man, I just want to go into my room and listen to some, you know, Michael Jackson or some, you know.
Rap music.
You know, rap music.
Raul y Mexia are next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Rapper Mexia Hernandez says he wants to be the voice of first-generation Latinos born in the United States. That's chutzpah, but Hernandez isn't just any aspiring musician. His father is Hernan Hernandez, frontman of the legendary Norteño band Los Tigres del Norte. They formed in the 1960s and still have a huge following in the U.S. and Mexico. Mexia and his younger brother Raul have just released their first album called Arriba y Lejos. It's an eclectic mix, reggaeton, cumbia, hip-hop, and a little of the old man's norteño as well. Raul y Mexia, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you for having us.
You're actually the first person that got Mexia's name right.
Really?
Yeah, usually.
I'll have to call my high school Spanish teacher and say I did something correct. You guys did not always work together. What were you doing as musicians before putting together this record?
Well, yeah, Mexia speaking. So, yeah, we both had our respective solo careers. After that, we decided to record a song called Todos Somos Arizona.
Right.
Which was in response to the SB 1070 law that was going on at the time. And so we wrote that song basically out of, you know, frustration. You know, we felt a sense of responsibility. You know, our father's band has always kind of been the voice for their generation in speaking on immigrant issues and social issues, political issues. You know, that kind of resonated with us. Jorge Ramos, who has his own show on Univision, actually invited us to his program, and from there we decided, hey, let's get together and decided to make this a career, see if we can, how far we can get with it.
So you put that up, made that song, went on Univision, and suddenly everybody said, kids, you should be stars.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of how it happened, actually.
That's exactly how it worked. I mean, you know, we had a lot of comments, a lot of people, you know, saying, you know, you guys are brothers. You know, your dad's groups, they're brothers and a cousin. You guys should get together. It kind of made sense. We were like, we're always with each other all the time anyways. If we're in the studio together, we're writing with each other. And since we're 8 years apart, when we were younger, we never really used to spend that brother time together.
Oh, you're really the little kid.
Yeah. But now this brought us close, and we're inseparable. We're at the hip pretty much every single day.
Since Todos Somos Arizona, are you still involved with immigration reform? I mean, the politics nationally of that have changed pretty dramatically in 3 years.
Of course. We're involved with the organization called MALDEF. We're also part of the Voto Latino. Those are issues that are very close to us. But with this album that we're promoting, Arriba y Lejos, we really tried to kind of stray away from that for this album to make a fun, diverse album. We feel that, you know, music is kind of an escape for some people, you know. We're just like, you know, any other Latino in the U.S., you know, who just wants to kind of forget about the situations for a while and relax, you know.
So talk to me about the various musical styles that are happening in this song.
I mean, it has a little bit of everything. It has that cumbia feel to it, but it also has that, you know, in the Latin industry, there's the music called tribal. It's really, really...
It's a fast-paced cumbia.
Yeah, fast-paced cumbia.
So you were born and raised and live in Northern California.
Correct.
Todos Somos Arizona was very much, as we heard, in Spanglish.
Right.
This album is mainly Spanish. Why that choice?
Well, definitely, I think we just wanted to do a little something different artistically and creatively. Spanish, you know, was our first language at home. So when I write a song, I really wanted to, like, how do I speak at home? We'll be, you know, remixing it up. We'll be talking to my mom. Hey, how are you? Hablaste con mi dad? You know what I mean? Did you talk with my dad?
Yeah.
You know, so we really wanted to, with this album, just really home in on Spanish and really hit the Mexican market, the Latin market, South America, Central America. And so in order to do that, we had to really be correct with our Spanish this time.
And I think that's why Todos Somos Arizona kind of had that little effect that it did because of who it was aimed towards. You know what I mean? A lot of people, well, obviously in Arizona, speak English and Spanish. So it's kind of one of those things that the youth kind of could catch on to, and they're like, oh, wow, you know, I hear the English, I also hear the Spanish in it.
So looking back to your musical roots, people should know that your father's band, Los Tigres del Norte, has put out 4 dozen albums over the last 40 years and sold 30-some million records. They are pretty much the group who brought Norteño to this country.
Yeah.
I want to play one of their songs. This is Los Tigres' Jaula de Oro, which means golden cage?
Yeah, the gold cage, yeah.
which is a ballad about an undocumented worker who really wants to go home to Mexico, but his family isn't having it.
Yeah.
Cuando me acuerdo hasta lloro, y aunque la jaula sea de oro, no deja de ser prisión.
Escúchame, hijo. ¿Te gustaría que regresáramos a vivir a México?
What you talking about, Dad? I don't want to go back to Mexico. No way, Dad.
Did that reflect your real life experience growing up? You guys just wanted to be Americans? Is there some basis in reality there?
Yeah, I mean, it's like anybody who's born here, you know, who have parents who are born somewhere else, you know, I think you have that loss of identity where you're, you know, you go to school and you learn one thing and then you go back home and you're learning another. And it gets really challenging because, I mean, of course, anybody who has friends wants to fit in. And as you get older, you start realizing, you know, you embrace your culture, you embrace everything that you were taught. But at the same time, you're born here, so you embrace, you know, the American side to it. You know, and that's what makes the hyphenated American so unique. You know, we hold on to our roots, but at the same time, we're going forward into the future, learning about different things and learning different cultures. You know, we have dual citizenship, so it was very important to our father that we become Mexican citizens.
And to us. Yeah.
And to us also.
And now, Mexiah, you have kids.
Definitely, yeah.
So there's another generation removed from the homeland. And for instance, do you speak Spanish to your kids?
Oh, yes, I definitely do. I try to speak as much Spanish as I can to them. But they're at that age, too, where they're, they go to school and they, the majority of their friends are speaking English. And, they, like my brother said, they want to fit in. I remember my personal stories, going to Mexico and not fitting in there. They're right off the bat. They call you a pocho or, a gringo. And then you come here back home. And it's just as bad, they're calling you other racial names or just thinking that you're just Mexican and not knowing, anything about American culture.
Mm-hmm.
I know my kids go through that. I know they have that culture shock sometimes. My wife, she's actually African American. So they have that, they're mixed. And so they talk to me and they ask me questions, well, can you teach me a little bit about, our Mexican culture? And then they go to my wife, can you teach me a little bit our African roots? And so I know, my younger son, we were watching the news when Obama got elected and, the majority of the votes of the reason why he got elected was because of the Latino vote. And so he was very proud of that.
Yep.
Even though he didn't vote, but he felt that he made a difference.
So growing up in a household that I assume you were surrounded by Norteño music growing up, were there periods as you grew up where like it seemed old fashioned and like enough of that, I don't want to listen to that anymore, Dad?
Yeah. I mean, you get that all the time. Our dad would come home and he'd be wearing the cowboy boots with the, silk shirt with button down to the midsection and with the gold chain, and you're kind of just like, Dad, really? Like, are you really wearing that right now? And then, all of a sudden he comes home, he's playing the accordion, the valsexto, and you're just kind of like, oh, man, again? Yeah. So it's kind of those type of situations. You're just like, man, I just want to go into my room and listen to some, Michael Jackson or some, James Brown or something,
And rap music.
Rap music and... But like I said, as soon as you get older, then you find yourself listening to the same music you were listening to when you were younger that your dad would put on and you'd be like, please shut it off, Dad. Please shut it off.
But I think those are experiences we wouldn't trade for anything. My brother and I always laugh about those type of experiences. But I think if we didn't go through that, we wouldn't be the people we are today.
Well, I want to play another song from the album where you can hear some of that Norteño influence. This is called Solo Para Ti. Come on. Oye, nadie te va a amar. Como yo te puedo amar, todo te lo quiero dar, dame una oportunidad. Es que yo te quiero y no puedo olvidar, el fuego de tu cuerpo que me hizo enamorar, el brillo de tus ojos me hace paralizar.
Yeah, it's a mixture of everything. That's kind of, like I said, what we set out to do with this album. That's the day and age we're living in today, I think there's really no boundaries. That's what the beautiful thing about this country is,
Well, I want to thank you, Raul and Mexia, so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Raul y Mexia's album, Arriba y Lejos, is out right now, and you can listen to a track at studio360.org. All this year, we're checking in with four of our listeners who told us about the great creative New Year's resolutions they made for 2013. One is going to make kind of a graphic novel. Another is writing a short story every month. And then there's Michael Relland in Phoenix. Michael teaches music to grade schoolers, and this year, he's going to play his own first solo recital on cello. I last talked to Michael in early January, so I called him to find out how things were progressing. School was just letting out.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
Good. So as I understand it, we called you at the school where you teach music. Are your students or some of your students aware of this project of yours?
Yeah, actually, today, every Friday, I have a little concert day, and the kids can play whatever they want. So I told them that I needed them to finish up their concert in time so I could have my interview. And they're like, what interview? And I said, well, it's an interview because I had a New Year's resolution to play a recital. And they said, well, you must play your song for us first. And so today, I was able to play a few songs for them, which was good. It's a tough crowd. It went well.
Good. Have you figured out exactly what you're going to play?
Well, I spread all the music out on the table. I had to, add the leaf in the table to make the table bigger to look at all the music because, you kind of look at your life's work. Here's the favorites I've liked since I was a kid. Here's the stuff I like to listen to. Here's the new stuff, the Germans and the Russians. Oh, I got the school sign announcements. Hold on. And I had a great idea to do it instead of just Bach suites, which I was originally thinking. I was starting with Bach, but then I'm going to go back 100 years and forward 100 years. So kind of the whole history of the cello, you know, from when it started through Bach and then into the more romantic stuff.
That is super. This new plan, rather than just playing some Bach suites, which would be ambitious enough, sounds really ambitious to try to do this history of the cello.
This would be kind of a nice hook, a nice, interesting theme.
Definitely. And, of course, as you're thinking about this, is this starting to take up a lot of your non-teaching, non-rest of your life time?
I get up in the morning, and I can do some, and I do a little bit after school, but it's not a have-to. It really needs to be relaxed, because if I start to stress out, my hands get stressed and tense. So, you know, I'm practicing probably 3-4 days a week.
Well, if your hands aren't too stressed on this Friday afternoon, you're there in the music room. I assume there's a cello near you. Would you mind playing us a piece?
That'd be great. Sure. This is Bach, but it's not from the cello suites. It's a piano piece. So, because I found out that, you know, there's the pile of stuff I know, but I'm trying to push myself, so I got this piano piece, arranged it for a cello. You'll hear a work in progress, you know?
Great. Our listener, Michael Rellin from Phoenix, who listens to the show by podcast. We'll be checking in with him again as he gets ready for his recital later this year, and you can keep up with all four of our New Year's resolutionists at studio360.org. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Alana Harper,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Ruth Samuelson.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can follow us on Twitter at Studio 360 Show, and or me at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. You can also find us on Facebook.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, master villain Jeremy Irons.
I'm hardly an inquisitor.
Then become one. We will cleanse this Vatican of ours of anyone who even thinks to question our fitness for this most holy of offices.
Being really good at being mean, great career move. I'll talk with actor Jeremy Irons next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.